This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hello and welcome to this week's 45th podcast. I'm here this week with Waj. Hey, Waj.
How's it going? This is the first time in a year that I am not speaking from my minivan.
You upgraded from the minivan office to an actual office?
I'm actually in my home, and the children are watching a cartoon and won't bother us, hopefully.
Totally. They're totally chill right now. They're not going to need anything. Not going to suddenly come over in 5 seconds and need some iced tea.
Yeah, of course. That's what's probably going to happen.
So, we are here we're 1 week into post-impeachment. And last episode, we recorded the night before the final vote. So let's do a quick recap of what happened. Trump was, as fully expected, acquitted. So there was a few things I was not necessarily worried about, or a little concerned about. There's a lot of talk, and it turned out to be just talk, that there were certain Democrats who were going to vote for acquittal across the board.
Manchin,
you know, Sinema, well, Alabama, who actually legit almost would be understandable. Not really. I wouldn't forgive him for it. But politically, the right move for him was probably to vote for acquittal.
He's a former prosecutor. He knows what's up, and he tried his best using his social media platform to explain his vote. I don't know if he'll save him, but he did the right thing at a cost.
He did. I mean, I don't know if it was a political decision or just a moral one, but he voted for removal. And here's something I kind of wonder a tiny bit. Before Manchin announced, and Manchin is his own thing. He's a West Virginian Democratic senator. You know, he's a different. It's Manchin's Manchin. Like, would rather have him than not have him.
It's his own thing, man.
His own thing. Like, whatever. But before Manchin announced, Romney announced. He went on the floor. It was mostly empty, and he gave a pretty incredible speech that, if you've not seen it in full, it's worth watching. In which he explained how, essentially, because he gave his oath before God to be an impartial juror at this trial, that oath gave him no option but to convict and vote for removal of the president.
Correct.
And then Manchin's like, oh, by the way, I'm also going to vote for removal, which I'm sure he always was. But like, if he'd been planning to not vote for removal, Romney kind of spoiled that one for him.
Apparently Romney and Sass, who allegedly was a moderate Republican, I don't think any moderate Republican exists now, so we can retire the term. They boarded the plane, and the entire plane burst into applause for Romney based upon his speech and vote. So we should also mention that Schlapp, who runs the CPAC, for those of you who don't know, is the Conservative Political Action Conference. It's like the who's who annual get together of like right-wing America in D.C. He openly said that if Mitt Romney were to come, he's afraid that he would actually get beat up. And he wasn't trying to be ironic or threatening. He like literally said if Romney was to show up at CPAC this year, he's afraid that he would actually be physically assaulted.
I think he was a bit threatening by that.
You think so?
Yeah. I mean, so the Senate Republicans have, you know, they've rallied around Romney. They've supported him. They have not publicly, that I've seen from any of them, indicated disapproval. I mean, they've expressed disagreement, but not disapproval of him. But outside of Republican senators, the GOP kind of has it out for Romney right now.
Oh, yeah.
Handing him pike and all that.
Everything. Like, he is target number one. In fact, right after the impeachment, you think they would spend so much time, like, crowing about Trump's victory, but it was all, like, systems go attack on Romney if you were to watch Fox News. Like, he is literally, like, the leftist liberal plant. And I'm old enough to remember that Mitt Romney was a 2012 Republican presidential candidate. That's just me. Maybe I'm crazy. Same thing about Bolton. Bolton is leftist. He's a leftist.
Oh, yeah, Bolton's a leftist tool.
Who was paid by Fox News over $550,000 a year for more than a decade and was a national security advisor for Donald Trump and was in the Bush administration. That man who wants to bomb Iran and get rid of the UN is, of course, our leftist Trojan horse. Yes.
God. So that was the impeachment trial. That was the acquittal. I'm really glad that Romney voted that way. I am less glad that there's not a single other Republican senator who saw fit to join him. I mean, what Romney did is prove that it's possible that you can't stand on principle. I mean, those guys, they knew he was, most of them knew he was guilty. Blackburn, nah, she is Looney Tunes. But most Republican senators know exactly what happened. I think a certain degree of partisanship has allowed them to think that maybe it's not so bad. So maybe they can rationalize it, but they know he's guilty of it.
It's like half-half. I actually went and saw it the day before the final vote. I went to D.C. And, like, you could tell, like, you know, you just tell. Romney was all the way in the back, didn't say a word. Blackburn just happened to be sitting in the row in front of him. Like there's like half who represent like the new GOP that they don't care. Like they're going to ride this to the end. There's others who are like older who get it, right? Like Alexander, for example, totally shameful. This guy's retiring. And he straight up admits what he did was, what was it? Improper. I think that was the word that was used. But we shouldn't impeach him. Yeah. And so it's very curious to see how low they'll go for Trump.
Well, it's even guys like Rubio, who is fully on board the Trump train. He's not at all one of the rebels. But what I think the distinction is that some of the Republican senators, they're fully on board with Trump. They're okay with supporting him. But they're not willing to insult themselves by pretending to believe his bullshit. Like, they don't want to go, like, they're like, okay, I will give it all for Trump. I will support him 100%. But I'm not going to publicly pretend to be such an idiot. I believe his defense. So that's the line they drew from themselves.
Like, because like Rubio is reek. He's like Marco Reek Rubio. Like this man has humiliated and insulted Rubio and now he's just a tool.
But even Rubio is not going to admit to like believing that bullshit defense. Like that's his own line. He'll still support him. He'll still support Trump in doing all this. He just doesn't want to be publicly seen as believing it.
Yeah, but like what's the point, right? Because now, I mean,
pride.
If you saw,
pure pride,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. And if you saw the the airing of grievances is what I call the rally, the rant, the White House post-acquittal conference that lasted more than an hour where he acted like a
that was insane.
Basic gangster, right? Like you just saw them laughing.
No. I'm sorry. Gangsters do not deserve to be sullied in that way. He was not acting like a gangster. I don't know what comparison I could possibly draw, but gangster is definitely not one of them.
Incompetent authoritarian?
No. It was a... You know what it was? It was a freaking, like... TV show host acting as an authoritarian on a game show.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I'll give it that.
That's about the only analogy I can draw because he went around and like listed like every Republican who supported him, and I think for 90% of them, maybe 95% of them, he always included a comment on their appearance. It was wild.
But it's very deliberate, and the reason why we shouldn't laugh at it too much, even though it was laughable, is this is what happens in authoritarian governments, right? You publicly praise the extreme loyalists. But you also mock them like a bully to flex a bit.
Is that true? Because like I can't even imagine Hitler being like, "Oh, here is my good supporter, so and so." But he has really weird ears. You ever looked at him before? Like, man, those ears are fucked up. Maybe Hitler did do that. I don't know.
because Trump is very narcissistic, insecure, and reckless. Right. That's why he's an incompetent bully. He can't help it. See. I don't know if this is better for us. I was having a conversation with someone yesterday. Is it better for America that he's an incompetent wannabe authoritarian, or is it worse? Because people like Stalin were much more strategic, much more disciplined, and thus much more effective in their cruelty. Trump is just self-destructive. Case in point, he praises Steve Scalise by literally mocking him. First, he says, he got whacked. No, he like survived an assassination attempt. Number two, he mocks his wife. Oh, some wives would be really happy. And I'm like, what type of concept of marriage do you have where like you're saying this, right? He's probably projecting like his own terrible marriages. And then third, he says, you look better now after the surgery because you look better looking now. It was like the weirdest exchange ever. And like Steve Scalise, who's traded like probably all of his dignity to suck up to Trump, just had to sit there and take it. And then he also mocks Chuck Grassley.
So I'm going to hard disagree with you. I don't think it's mockery at all. I think it's stream of consciousness.
Deliberately or what?
I think it's his like instincts as like a TV host and a owner of a beauty pageant where he's just constantly remarking on the livestock around him.
Yeah, but the main thing is he owns livestock. It's about power and control as well.
But also, I think he sincerely means it. I think he's told that story enough times about Scalise's wife where I think he genuinely was struck by it. And he tells that story because he's like, whoa, Scalise's wife was like distraught. She was like truly upset that her husband might die. Like it was incredible to see. I think it really just stuck with him that like she was so visibly upset and losing it with grief.
Yeah, but I think, look, let me put it this way. I think he's sincere in his mockery. Like, I think he really believes that. Like, when he was saying all those things, he believes it. Like, you know what I'm saying? And it's also like a bully flexing, like, I have control over you. And
or it's jealousy too. Like, he also has this weird, like, way of talking about men's bodies all the time, which is, it's not like, it's not gay exactly. I'm not suggesting he's like actually attracted to them in that fashion, but he has like a really like detailed way of like describing men's physiques and men's bodies that's kind of fascinating to see, like, in any like political figure these days to do that, let alone Trump. But like, he'll like start talking about Jim Jordan. He's like, he doesn't wear jackets. He wants to show off that body.
Well, he does it also with, I mean, it goes back to kind of your point of how he sees everything like livestock, right? Like the reality TV show host, the way he used to treat women when it came to his pageants. Like, let's not forget that he passed over Bolton initially because he didn't like his mustache. And he chose Manafort in addition to the recommendation by Tom Barrack, but because he thought he really liked his hairstyle and how he always looked.
Look, Trump was right about the mustache, all I can say. Trump should have followed his instincts.
But this is the man that we have decided to kill our democracy for, a corrupt vulgarian and reality TV show. So that's what kills me. Like, if you're Republican.
It does get to me, yeah.
Did you ever think, like, you do it for Reagan, okay? Maybe you do it for Bush. Maybe
like, this is what we threw it away for? Really? Like guys, come on.
This. You threw it, like Ted Cruz is going to humiliate himself for life for this. That's what should kill you if you're Republican.
So, as a professional working woman trying to get ready in the mornings, when it comes to shoes, I feel like I have three choices before me. Cute, comfortable, and professional. But you can only choose two. You can have cute professional shoes. You can have some comfortable professional shoes. You ain't getting all three together. Until now. Because Rothy's is the shoe I did not know about and wish I had much sooner. Rothy's are the perfect everyday shoe for life on the go. They are stylish and comfortable, and they go with everything. Like, seriously, I've worn my Rothy's with an absurd range of outfits. That's why Rothy's has quickly grown to the most loved gotta-have brand. It is no surprise that they have over 1,000 nearly perfect reviews. These shoes are stylish, sustainable, comfortable, and washable, all in one pair of shoes. They're the perfect flats for life on the go. My favorite pair used to be my The Point shoe, the one that I unfortunately chose the exact same as Rabia for, because they're really, really freaking cute. But I also have a pair of their Chelsea's, which have become my new favorite pair of shoes ever, because they work for everything, and they are super comfortable, and also they're really shiny and blue. So, all I need is a pair of shoe. Like, if you want a pair of flats that are really cute and will get you through anything, this is your go-to. I'm not kidding. Check out all their amazing styles available right now at rothys.com/45th. Go to rothys.com, rothys.com/45th, to get your new favorite pair of flats. Comfort, style, and sustainability, these are the shoes you've been waiting for. Head to rothys.com/45th today.
Oh, we have to talk about Susan Collins. Susan Collins is just very concerned and very troubled and deeply disappointed, and she believes that Trump has learned his lesson. And then he did this airing of grievances, and now he's done the weaponizing of the DOJ. But I'm sure she's very concerned and troubled.
I do think there's a degree of sexism in how Collins is treated, and that she's continually covered in media as if it's at all plausible she believes what she's saying. Susan Collins is a powerful woman who knows what she's doing. Like, there is no, like, surprise or, like, oh, didn't see that coming about it. Like, she knows exactly what she's doing.
But do you think that's why the stigma is on her, and because she was allegedly a moderate? And
I think she effectively plays the role of a moderate, or plays the part of a moderate on camera. Not in her voting, not in her actual political career, but she has done very well at making a stage performance of being a moderate, which the media still believes for reasons I'm not entirely sure about. Murkowski is a more genuine moderate than Collins is by far. And Murkowski, I mean, obviously too, did not vote for removal.
She was much more like snarky about it.
Murkowski's more genuine. Like, I say that very like relatively compared to Collins, but Murkowski is much more genuine. Collins, it's all an act, and I don't know why we're still pretending to fall for it.
Well, I mean, everyone falls for it. Like, even I'm glad that no one says it about Sass anymore. I think they just made peace with it. There's no.
I think Sass just sad. He's not even a pretend moderate. He's just like a wannabe flake.
Yeah, well, the thing is, he's a wannabe flake. He's actually intellectual. He's smart. He gets it. But now he's like, all right, if I have to survive, this is what I have to do. And I was talking to a conservative strategist, and he says the Faustian bargain they've made is if we go against Trump, the short-term pain is that he'll try to blast you. Look at Romney. Long-term, we'll ride this out because maybe he'll win and maybe it'll be like, you know, a one-party system. But most of them know he's terrible.
Yeah. The saddest thing I can say about Sass is that, like, you, sir, are no Senator Flake. Like, you wish you could be, but that is...
You, sir, are no Flake. Yeah. One day you might evolve to a Collins. And he just starts breaking down and crying.
No, I still put Flake ahead of Collins because Flake is, like, you can see his, like, true, or you could have, when he was in office, you could see, like, he was torn. I think he was genuinely torn a lot of the time. But then he would choose against himself, like, every single time. But, like, I think his well, maybe I'm falling for it, too. But I think his displays of being torn were genuine enough.
Well, I mean, the reason being, like, a lot of people ask, why do people do this? And I think it's important. You know, in D.C. especially, if you're listening to this, it's a right-wing ecosystem. So it's, especially now with Trump and how he has controlled the party, the vengeance and retribution is not just against you. It's against your social life, your family, your post-political career as a potential lobbyist or a contributor or a columnist or a talking head or an attorney who lands at a private firm. It is a very tightly connected ecosystem. And so now that it's so thoroughly dominated by Trump, at least in the short run, they are like, okay, like Will Hurt, excellent example. Smart guy, ex-CIA, knows what's up.
Oh, he wants to run for president.
Well, that's it. He knows how dangerous this is. And you saw how muted he was in the House impeachment. And the reason being is he's like, all right, I might have a post-political career here, a post-House career, and I might run for governor or I might run for president. And there you go. That's the cynical play. And so they're going to go. And the reason why this is so disastrous is they're voluntarily enabling an authoritarian in the form of an incompetent, reckless vulgarian, Trump. It's like giving a gun to a person who will shoot you and then giving him all the bullets and like giving him all of your shields and then just praying that he doesn't turn on you. And I'm like, have you not paid attention to Trump? He's loyal to nobody but Trump. And I'm really curious to see when the GOP will figure out that he will betray them. Maybe it's in 2 years. I don't know.
If I had to guess, and I hate to try and do this kind of mind reading because, again, these are all people whose careers depend on portraying something on news and on TV. I think a lot of them, I think the Collinses and the Herds of the world can justify it in part because of his incompetence and recklessness, because they can tell themselves that he can't actually do much harm. I mean, look at the guy. I think that's part of the calculus in their heads is that, like, okay, do they actually like him? No, they're not the supporters of him. They're the ones that are like, you know, mildly distasteful of it all, but whatever. I think they've told themselves that this can't be a real problem. There's nothing actually to be concerned about here because, you know, it's Trump. What real harm could there possibly be?
And then we'll see this week what harm there could be.
Yes.
I'll give you one one word, Roger Stone.
So we are now in the first week post-impeachment, and this is one of the worst outcomes we could have had. I still will firmly defend that impeachment had to happen. There was no other choice.
No, completely agree. Like, completely agree.
Whatever happened, it had to be done. Unfortunately, it means now that Trump has realized his domination of the GOP is complete and that there is actually nothing to stop him aside from losing the 2020 election. But Congress, but Senate, no one on the Hill from the Republican Party other than Romney is going to do a damn thing to stop him no matter what he does. So right now, going forward, his entire calculus is what will help him get one, reelected, but also get him all the other things he wants. And as long as he can do that without harming his reelection chances, he's in for it.
And he has weaponized the DOJ, which means more sham investigations to any Democratic nominee who surges. He has a huge chest, hundreds of millions of dollars that he has unleashed in disinformation and ad campaigns. He has the entire right-wing infrastructure that has bent the knee to him. Including all the Republicans in Congress. And because we are both sizing ourselves to authoritarianism, and apparently the economy is good, even though it's not for a lot of people, and the Democrats can't get their shit together and fight a knife fight because they bring a policy paper to a knife fight and punch themselves in the face, we might be looking at 4 more years of Trump, or Bloomberg, I think, will rise.
Oh, Jesus Christ. No, no. I'm not even doing that.
Why? Just listen. I want to put
you know, I don't care. You know what? Moving on. I don't even care about that.
Don't underestimate Bloomberg, the rise of Bloomberg.
Oh, I'm not underestimating what billions of dollars can do unleashed for private ends. But we're not there yet. And also, I still believe in traditional indicators of how the economy's going to go. And again, there are arguments to be made that the inversion we had in the yield curve last year might not have been caused for typical reasons. But I still think 17 months out, on average, you get your recession. And I think, what, 2 months from now, we're going to hit that mark? So I'm not confident the economy is going to support Trump. I don't think at this point, I used to be more confident that when the economy turns south, that would be a much bigger problem for Trump's reelection. I am now much less confident in that. I still think that he's not going to be able to ride the economy this great way forever.
So can I respond real quick? I agree with you completely, but the timing is where I disagree. Once the economy goes south, which it will under Trump and Republicans, it always does, the deficits increased, the debts increased, trade war was disastrous, China right now with the coronavirus, the economy is hurting them. The tax cut, we're all going to pay for it. It didn't juice the economy. They've spent so much to give a artificial boost to the economy to let him ride this out until the election. If the recession comes after his election, then it shatters the myth of the art of the deal. It shatters the myth of Trump, which is why he won in the first place. However, he will be so authoritarian that we have to ride it. It's going to be like 2006 times 10. That's what my fear is. And it, almost in a strange way, if I have to be strategic about it, even though I don't want this to happen, if the recession has to happen or if there has to be a dip, I pray it happens before the election so that he gets dented by at least that 1 or 2 points that might be the margin needed for Democrats to win. So I agree with you.
Ideal scenario, it happens after he loses and we have a president in place to actually handle the consequences.
Which is what happened in 2008.
I mean, at this point, I'm not even saying it has to be a Democrat at this point. We need someone not Trump in place for when it happens. I don't think coronavirus is going to do it. That is not the issue here. I still think that we have the repo crisis has not been dealt with, but that's for a later episode of when it happens. Moving on to the 1 week post-impeachment or post-acquittal. Giuliani, there was a report today, not seen confirmed by anyone else, but, you know, I'm going to believe it anyway because it sounds believable, that Giuliani is not expected to face charges in SDNY in New York alongside Parnas and Freeman and the others. Which, of course, he's not, because he's Trump's crony, so why would he face charges? But let's look at what has happened since the impeachment. Giuliani now has a direct line to DOJ to feed them his bullshit Ukrainian disinformation. The part that I still haven't figured out, though, is how Barr set it up. So Barr chose the federal prosecutor in Pittsburgh to be the receiving end of the Giuliani bullshit, which... Maybe the Pittsburgh guy could be trusted more, the AUSA there, or the attorney there in charge. I'm not sure why. So we know it's separate from Durham's investigation. This Durham's the guy who was put in charge of the determining the origins of the Russia probe.
He's looking at the FBI right now. The deep state, quote unquote, which does not exist, by the way.
I'll preface this by saying I am very disturbed by the idea that Giuliani gets a direct access to give his
should be. We all should be. The fact that it's been admitted by Bill Barr himself that there is a separate line set up to receive basically bullshit disinformation by Rudy Giuliani, who has no DOJ authority and is working in his private capacity as the attorney of President Trump.
Yeah, it's extremely disturbing. So I'm not saying this is a defense of it by any means. If anything, this is a different kind of appalling critique of the system. I do think that Barr set this up as a way to discreetly shuffle Giuliani off into a corner. I don't think Barr is genuinely interested in pursuing this stuff.
Just to quarantine him, you mean?
I do. Yeah. I think that is largely what the purpose of this is. Now, Barr still is going to pursue Ukraine stuff and still pursue the Russia hoax, quote unquote, thing. That's not stopped in any way, shape, or form. I do think Barr doesn't see Giuliani as being in any way a help to him there. So this is his way of quarantining Giuliani's bullshit from the more sinister bullshit he's trying to pull off.
Oh, that's fair. Okay, that's fair. And that's a reason why, going back to our initial conversation of the airing of grievances post-acquittal, Trump did not mention two people, and it was very specific and stood out. He did not mention Giuliani. He did not mention Mulvaney.
Yeah, poor Mulvaney.
You see that photo of all of them on the plane coming back from Iowa, and it was Ben Carson in the middle as a token black man, but the only person who's like, help me, was Mick Mulvaney on the right-hand side. Go back and see the photo if you get. Just look at
But he's Mulvaney. Not – Mulvaney is like a willing captive because he – if he wanted to step aside, he could. They want him gone, but they can't force him out, and he's still staying.
He's still acting, by the way, guys.
Oh, God. It's just like I don't have sympathy for him exactly, but he's such a sad figure that I kind of do anyway.
They're all going to be sad figures. They're all going to be sad figures at the end of the day.
But still, like – top awards for sad figures, you know, it's going to Giuliani. There's no one else I can go to. And by the way, I have now watched every episode of Giuliani's podcast. I'm doing air quotes, you can't see it, but air quotes. His podcast, which is in fact not a podcast, but a series of YouTube videos that he calls a podcast. And it makes me angry every time. Like, goddamn boomers. Like, can you not figure this shit out?
What's this? Is this on? Is this on? You're like, yes, you don't have to yell, huh? Can they see me? You're like, yes, it's a YouTube.
Oh my God. So you can watch it yourself. Don't watch all of it like I did because that's just torture. But go to his website. His site is called Rudy Giuliani's Common Sense. So his URL is rudygiulianics.com. Like Rudy Giuliani CS, Common Sense. But it sounds like some kind of like Scientology platform, like Giulianics. Like, what is that?
Did he set it up himself?
Oh, God, no. Oh, God, no. He has that, like, that whatever her name is, like the Team MAGA pageant winner girl.
What happens if Don Jr.'s boss did it, his girlfriend?
No. Kimberly. It's called, like, the MAGA pageant. I don't even know what it was. But, like, the MAGA lady winner works for Giuliani, and she does a lot of the stuff. I'm sure she hired someone to do it. Anyway, point being, his podcast / YouTube videos, which no one pays attention to because it's Giuliani, you can hear the actual theory that Trump is trying to promote, which is, one, Biden did all kinds of corrupt stuff over there, but also tried to kill Prosecutor Shokin twice.
Tried to kill? Wow.
Yeah. Tried it with mercury poisoning. That's exactly how former Vice President of the United States would try and assassinate someone overseas, is through mercury poisoning. Yeah. And it didn't even work. Shokin lived. But so, like the whole theory Giuliani's promoting is not anything like you hear on TV. Even Fox News doesn't run the whole theory because it's too stupid. Giuliani's theory is that, like, actually Hunter Biden's not involved at all. Hunter Biden's basically innocent other than being a patsy who lets his name be used. That John Kerry and Biden weaponized the Department of State and the presidency to become lobbyists for foreign dictators, and the payments through Burisma, through Hunter Biden, that was really just a side way of paying out Joe Biden. Like, there was nothing, like, Hunter Biden was not really even, like, guilty of anything other than being a figurehead. Like, the whole idea was to use Hunter Biden to pay out Joe Biden for offering his protection to this Ukrainian oligarch. And there's more crazy stuff that happened there, like attempted assassination. It's all just crazy nonsense. Anyway, point being, he apparently is so desperate. This is not only something he's doing for the president for no fee. He also has to, like us regular Joes out there, hustle for the podcast advertisements. And here is what's keeping RudyGiulianics.com afloat.
Number one. The top ones are going to be hard to get. So subscribe to Cigar Aficionado right now through the link on our website. And then go get the ones that are left or order them and smoke them. And see if you agree with the ratings and let me know.
Yeah, so in between listening to Giuliani talk about these really batshit Ukrainian conspiracy theories, you can hear all of his thoughts on cigars and cigar smoking.
This is where, you know, the funny thing, we laugh at this, but
I'm not laughing.
I don't laugh at this either. Like, it's just like the New York Times, I write for the Times, but just today, they, without like any irony or any like correction, mentioned the deep state in the headline. And I'm like, once you normalize this stuff, people get confused. Like, average people get confused. Holy and so much shit. So with the Biden stuff, I remember like an average person was saying a month ago, like, you know, they see me on CNN, so it's in my neighborhood. And they're like, like, hey, is something really happening with Hunter Biden? And that's it. That's how it works. You flood the zone with disinformation. Steve Bannon has openly said it. That's what happens in authoritarian regimes. Trust nothing. Trust no one. Trust no institution. Always have doubt. Trust only the chosen one.
Maggie Haberman is so dangerous at the times. Oh, my God. The way she writes about Trump is like she's like the Trump whisperer who can read his thoughts and like portray this epic battle that he's a, you know, the star figure in as if talking from his viewpoint. It's really disturbing.
Do you think it's done intentionally?
No, I think she believes her own bullshit. I think she's very close to Trump, not in a bad way necessarily. Like, she's been on the beat for a long time, so she knows him well. So it's like an alien, like, subject matter that she's, like, very familiar with. She knows how it operates. She knows if you give light here and some water here, it's going to respond this way. And she's, like, internalized this creature that's Trump. And she writes from its viewpoint because she feels like she's so close to her subject that she can understand his impulses. And I think she probably can. Like, I don't actually doubt that part of her reporting. But the way she writes stuff, oh, my God.
Well, we've normalized it, right? And
That's different. Like, well, that's part of normalizing. That's, like, I mean, she's writing from a viewpoint where the authoritarian's in power and it's supposed to be that way. And here's how he sees the world. And here's how, I mean, okay, from her, I get it. It is valuable to know how the authoritarian sees the world. I would want to know that too. But any kind of coverage that portrays, like, does not put that context there as like, here is how this crazy dude thinks. That is dangerous.
Yeah, and we're missing the context. I agree with you. We're missing the context. And I'm just, I don't know if the damage is done. I mean, what's so worrying is that there was an article that came out in today's New York Times talking about this massive disinformation campaign. It was an analysis done by McKay Coppin's piece in The Atlantic. And I recommend people reading it. Like, he just decided for The Atlantic to go in to like the Fox News echo chamber. And he's like, you know, he deliberately went in knowing full well that he was going to write a piece on it. And he says, like, even though he was aware with like his eyes wide open, he got discombobulated. So can you imagine the average person who doesn't know that they're being fed malicious propaganda? It's like so dangerous. And here we are. No one believes anything. There's conspiracy theories afoot. We have Bill Barr literally traveling around the world on taxpayer dollars, trying to find information on a nonsense Russian propaganda theory of CrowdStrike, where it wasn't Russia interfering in the election, it was Ukraine. And now he has weaponized the DOJ and basically is working with and or quarantining Giuliani, who will not go to jail. And meanwhile, you have Lev Parnas saying, hey, everybody, I got the tapes. Anyone want to listen to me? And we don't care. And the election's 8 months away.
I care, Lev Parnas. I care. I think he should be convicted but I still care. Oh, Lev Parnas, please come on this podcast. I'll be very friendly to you. I won't ask about your LNG deals. I will stay away from the stuff that any defendant facing indictment shouldn't talk about. I'll be kind in that regard. Just come on the podcast and tell me all about the stuff that I know you can talk about.
We promise it'll be a one-on-one conversation.
Dude, hey, Lev Parnas, if you're listening, hit me up. I'll be very kind to you. I'll promise not to get, like, as a criminal defense attorney, I don't want you talking about certain things in the air. Like, I don't. I don't want any criminal defendant talking about that. I won't even go into it. Just come here and talk about the stuff that I know you can talk about. Anyway, Roger Ratfucking Stone is being convicted, facing sentencing. And this week we had the DOJ file its sentencing memorandum in advance of the upcoming sentencing for his convictions on lying to Congress and witness tampering. Now, I want to, in advance of all this discussion, I want to say that, like, sentencing in the United States is extraordinarily bullshit. And
true.
The charges that Stone was facing are genuinely unjust. They just are. So are the charges almost every defendant in the United States faces. But under the guidelines, which is how federal sentences are calculated, the guidelines give you a sentence of 7 to 9 years. And that wasn't the DOJ doing it. That was pretrial services, their own calculations. Like, the calculations are clear. That part is not in doubt. If you calculate the sentences the way every other defendant in the United States has their sentence calculated, 7 to 9 years. And I don't want to defend that because I can't, and it shouldn't be defended. It's wrong. but so is the sentence of basically everyone else in the United States. It's not in any way uniquely wrong for Roger Stone at all. At all. And also, not to get off on the criminal justice stuff, because that's all for undisclosed, but it's called the trial penalty. If you plea out, you can get much less time on charges. So if Roger Stone had pled out and had cooperated, he'd probably be facing, what, a year max, if that? And the trial penalty is in itself bullshit and should not be a part of our system, but it is. It's fully part of our system, which means someone doesn't cooperate by the books without any kind of political influence whatsoever is going to face a sentence like what Roger Stone is facing now. So all that being said, because it kind of kills me inside to try and like defend that kind of sentence when I can't, I'm not defending the sentence. The point being, it was by the books, because our books are extremely fucked up, and that is how they calculate sentences. It was by the book.
Right.
So we have that sentence going to come out, and then we have, at 2 a.m. that evening following, Trump was apparently still riled up about it and started tweeting out how the DOJ should be ashamed of what they did and, like, this that was unjust and whatever MAGA bullshit he likes to talk about. And, I mean, wow, that's not okay at all. Like, even in our current world, that was still pretty egregious. But it got worse. It got much, 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 much worse, because the next day there was reports that, oh, DOJ thinks they should not charge that much. They should ask for less of a sentence.
They interfere and recommend reduced
sentencing. Oh, my God.
The coincidentally following this extremely improper tweet by Donald Trump interfering in our independent judicial system, where Roger Stone was tried and convicted very quickly by a jury of his peers on 7 felony counts.
And I still don't know if there's ever been an example that's happened before. I don't think there is, because I've never heard of it happening.
Never.
It's not exactly white collar, but it's a white collar kind of offense. This is never what happens. The DOJ doesn't take any mercy on anyone who doesn't plea out. And they then, the very next day, filed a memorandum saying, oh, we changed our minds. That was excessive. We can't give you any legal rationale for why it was. We can't give you any explanation of how the guidelines don't demand the sentence we asked before. But we just think it sounds kind of excessive. So we asked for a, quote, far less sentence than what was previously requested. And then all four of the attorneys, prosecutors from the Stone team, handed in resignations from, well, three of them withdrew from the case, one withdrew from the case and resigned from DOJ.
Which is huge, which is also very huge and unprecedented to have.
It was hugest. I will admit, I'm still disappointed that they didn't actually resign in full.
In the other three?
Yeah, like, it's a huge thing to ask of anyone. It is a very, I don't want to throw it around lightly, but like, oh, why didn't they just resign? They got handled in this way. Like, why didn't they really show their protest by resigning their whole job? That is a huge ask. It's not a light move. It's not something you can just casually do. I'm still disappointed it didn't happen, because this is the kind of thing where, like, one, your career is dead anyway. I mean, that's easy for me to say. But those prosecutors, they know their career is probably dead. They've been blacklisted. So it's not like they're giving up everything like they usually would. They're just giving up most things. And we need more of these resignations and refusals to carry out just orders instead of just withdrawing from the case.
Well, you mentioned it. The reason is a lot of people, I'm in Virginia right now. We both are close by here. We know that a lot of these people, including Republicans, by the way, who are opposed to Trump or realize how dangerous he is, it's two things. Number one, if I quit, how am I going to have a career and have a mortgage? Yada, yada, the usual stuff. The other thing, it's worth noting.
But it's more so for these guys. These are not political appointees usually. These are like, this is their whole career. This is not just like a political thing. This is like, you wanted to be attorney, you wanted to be a prosecutor. You had your whole life lined up for this.
And it took a long, it's very tough. It's very like the creme de la creme. You've worked hard, you've moved up. And the other point I was saying is, they're like, if I leave or if I quit or if I resign, who else will come in my place? It'll be a Trump loyalist. And now this already compromised institution will be completely taken over and hijacked. So do you stay and enable essentially a corrupt system under a corrupt government corrupt administration, or do you stay and resist? Is basically you staying an active resistance by you protecting that slot and not ceding it to a Nunes type character, a Reek. That's all.
I'd quit, but I'm not in the position, and I can see how if I was there, I could easily be like, oh, well, rather than quitting, it's better just to stay in place and continue to do good work like I wanted to do all along. I'd like to think that I'd quit.
We have so many friends. I have so many friends in DHS, at DOJ, State Department, who literally are holding the line, like survive.
But when you're given the request, when you're given the instruction that violates why you're there.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think you can ethically stay for a very long time, but when you're given that order and there's not, your only choices are to like step away or comply, you step away publicly by quitting.
But you know what? I don't necessarily disagree with you. And I think the move it was very profound. And to make it worse, Bill Barr did a press conference for like a minute where he did answered one question and then just stepped away. And then Donald Trump today just tweeted out in support of the move of the DOJ. And not only that, wondered out loud on Twitter whether or not it was trumped up charges, and then dragged Robert Mueller.
Thanked Barr for taking over this case. Oh my God.
I mean, it's like, how bad could it be? That's how bad it is.
The same day this all went down, Barr gave a speech for some law enforcement group somewhere, in which he attacked, quote, rogue DAs for the social justice, quote unquote, DAs, like people like Larry Krasner in Philadelphia are the San Francisco DA. And he attacked them for like how they are causing this mass crime wave and like savaged them, not by name, but by very specific identity for their approach to law enforcement, where they didn't charge people all the time, where they didn't seek mass incarceration. And Barr's actual words were like, they are harming the public by not seeking to charge every petty offense. By recording and charging and convicting every petty offense, protect the public and the people involved. The defendants themselves are helped by having petty convictions pursued. And by the way, what these rogue DAs are doing is allowing witness intimidation and allowing crimes to go unpunished because the witnesses are too intimidated to come forward.
Go back and read or see Barr's speech at the University of Notre Dame from a few months ago. You will get his entire worldview. As a sitting attorney general, he's basically convinced that Western civilization is under threat by the quote-unquote secularists. And the secularists oftentimes stands for Jews, stands for Black people, immigrants, liberals, feminists, homosexuals, like literally all of the rest of us. So the sitting attorney general, and I think this gives you the worldview as to why Barr is doing what he's doing. Number one, it's ideological. I think it's all ideological. He has his most expansive view of the executive authority, which he tried to do when he was first-time attorney general. But now he has the willing, blunt instrument that is Trump. But secondly, there is this type of right-wing religious ideology, which believes that he has to save Western civilization and America from the threat of the enemy, which is all of us. And so the ends justify the means, which goes back to the 2016 election and what we're dealing with, which is an increasingly extremist minority party, which treated the 2016 election as, wait for it, the Flight 93 election. That's what they called it. You have to charge the cockpit, because if we lose this one, it's all over. The reason why I'm mentioning this is they are convinced that this is an all or nothing absolutist fight, and they're willing to fight until the end. And meanwhile, we hold press conferences. So we're effed.
Barr is the most dangerous person in Trump's cabinet because he is not fundamentally a political actor. I mean, most of them are. Most people in Trump's cabinet are political. Pompeo is political.
Came out of retirement for this.
No, Barr is not doing it for the politics. He is not doing it because he has any grand ambitions for his own personal office. Barr is doing it because he's a crusader. Because he believes that the outcome he seeks justifies anything.
That's what I'm saying. That's why he's so dangerous, and I don't know why. I mean, I've been saying this since yesterday.
Also one of the few in Trump's cabinet who's actually competent, too. So he is the worst of all worlds.
And I've been – ever since I saw that tweet on Friday, I've been telling – what power do I have? Like just shouting it from Twitter and Facebook and like telling others Like, this is the story. This is, forget New Hampshire. No offense to New Hampshire. I don't care about New Hampshire, Iowa, because it's like the two whitest states. And no offense to the two whitest states, but the Democratic Party is a party that is diverse and people of color are the base. And so we won't really know anything until South Carolina, but I digress. But I'm like, right now everyone's talking about New Hampshire. I'm like, this is the story. The fact that Bill Barr is the Luca Brasi henchman of Donald Trump, weaponizing the DOJ as literally the blunt force trauma instrument to whack all of his enemies. And he's going to come after literally every single Democratic nominee that surges. How come Democrats aren't doing anything? But guess what, Susan? Chuck Schumer earlier today said they're going to have Barr testify late March.
Yeah. See, I don't think the gang analogies work for Barr because he's a different creature. He's not a he's not there as a mob boss advisor. He's not there for personal enrichment or for even for loyalty to any individuals. I don't think he's loyal to Trump in any shape or form. He is on a crusade.
Use the analogy of blunt instrument. That's the same analogy used by Steve Bannon when it came to Trump. In 2015, the Bloomberg article, that's what Bannon said. He said, yeah. Trump is our blunt instrument. He doesn't get it, but that's fine. It is Bannon's ideology. I think Barr uses him the exact same way.
Barr is a matter. Bannon who is not suicidal and desiring a massive implosion of the world order.
Yeah, I agree with that. And the ends justify the means. Bannon wants to burn everything down based on Bannon's own comments. People, like, that's why
I think Bannon wants to burn the world down, period. Like, he has justification for why, but like his ultimate goal is to like just burn it all the fucking to the ground. Barr has a specific utopia he wants to get us to.
No, but so does Bannon. See, Bannon is different from some of the other people who are just jokers and nihilists. He's openly said he's a Leninist who wants to burn it all down and then replace it with this vision. That's where Bannon and Barr are. The way they go about it is different. There's another part of Trump's base, and I don't know if we talked about this on this podcast, which I'm convinced they want to burn it all down. It's like this. If I have to give a power to Susan, who has boobs, and Wajahat, who's brown skin, F that. If I go down, you go down. That's a part of the MAGA base. But then the other part, which is probably scarier, are the Barrs and the Bannons, because they have a very refined, specific ideology. They want to burn it all down and replace it with something else. So who's scarier?
Mostly the Barrs, because the Bannons they're scary in their own right, but they're also not that competent. I mean, they're still terrifying. Don't want to downplay that part. But the Bannons we can deal with. The Barrs, who are in the system, of the system, love the system, they're the real danger.
How do you get rid of Barr? Well, how do you contain Barr if you're a Democrat?
The thing is, he is like a virus that is immune to your immune system, because he is a swamp creature, quote unquote, to use Trump's terminology, and that he has swam in these waters his whole life. He went through Iran-Contra and he like recommended pardons for Iran-Contra people. He's been here, done that. He has the establishment credentials. He has the connections. No one's going to call him out for what he is. You deal with Barr by, I mean, getting him before Congress much sooner than 6 weeks from now, if he even shows up, which I'm skeptical of.
He's not.
Barr, you can't defeat Barr in our current system. You defeat Trump. And you can't defeat Trump in our current system because the Senate is controlled by Republicans who will never stop him for anything.
So this is what I say. If the Democrats were good at messaging, but they're terrible, your audience is the American public for everything. You know Republicans won't do anything. You know you're going to be stymied. You know you're going to be stalled. Fine. You just dominate the headlines as much as you can, and you chip away at Trump. Chip away, chip away, chip away.
No, we're beyond that.
You don't think so?
I don't know what the answer is. I don't know what the best path forward is. But I don't think traditional headline messaging is the way out, because Trump has his base. They're not a majority by any means, but he has his base that's untouchable.
But then it's the recession then. That's it.
But on top of that, you have the recession would hurt him. I used to be more confident that when it came, that would be more of a death knell to his campaign. I am no longer certain of that. Also because Democrats being normal political actors are, you know, all over the place right now. They'll figure that shit out. It's fine. But it's definitely not part of a long-term strategy, which is good. I don't think that there should be any effort to try and coordinate Democratic nominees with a, you know, big grand picture design of defeating Trump. That's not the solution here. But it definitely does mean that they're at a bit of a structural disadvantage coming into 2020.
And but you know what though then the win might be? You take the Senate. And I think they could take the Senate.
Well, let me add that. Yes, if Trump wins in 2020, I want the Senate. But
because if you get the Senate and you get the House, you can contain him, and then you could pull a McConnell and just hold that seat, maybe that two seats. If Ginsburg retires and another person retires, just hold it and pull a Merrick Garland. I'm trying to plot every option because I think we're a step away from authoritarianism, and I think it's like all systems are flashing red. And some people are slowly waking up to it, but a lot of people are like, it'll be fine. And I'm just like, why do you think it'll be fine? Because the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice, something, something. And I'm like, or it can bend towards injustice. You have to bend it towards justice.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Normally, I'm Debbie Downer. I know that. But here is my ray of hope for week one post-impeachment. Things are bad, sure. Things are definitely not ideal for democracy. But here's what we've got going for us. One, the wannabe authoritarian is facing some real physical limitations that put a cap on his total possible duration of control. And two, his designated successor was initially Ivanka. She's not going to catch on with the base. So, you know, putting her in the West Wing was not going to help because it's not going to be her. His backup replacement is Don Jr., who doesn't have daddy's skills such as they are for demagoguery. Like, He got a lot of the Trumpian characteristics, but the thing Trump has that allows him to be Trump did not get passed on to his namesake. So, yeah, we got that going for us. Things like after this is all over, it's not going to be good. There's a lot of work to be done. We do have that ray of hope to go on.
So what I will say is the two rays of hope are, number one, Trump is a reckless creature who can't help but self-destruct. He just can't help it. Case in point.
That's not a ray of hope. That's going to happen for sure. That's the aftermath we got to deal with.
But I mean, what I'm saying is if he was remotely tempered, skilled, strategic, he could run circles around Democrats. He creates his own disasters. And we have 9 more months of an unbridled, reckless Trump unchained by anything. In a way, his hubris can cause him to trip up just enough. That's one. Number two, because he is in his own sanctuary, and is declining, I agree with you that Ivanka was never going to be the placeholder. It's Don Jr. They love Don Jr., but they don't love him enough because Trump is a singular creature of America, like molded by pop culture, media, wealth, materialism, racism. Like he's like the perfect Frankenstein. And Don Jr., like, you can only inherit so much, but the sequel is going to just fizzle out. My fear is someone will take the Trump playbook, someone who's very refined, has good hair, doesn't have orange skin, is a bit younger, has a normal, healthy marriage, and that will be your smiling demagogue and authoritarian. And that's my fear.
I am less afraid of that. I'm still skeptical that you can have that, kind of authoritarian, like in the modern world, that you can have someone who is otherwise, for lack of a better word, competent and normal, that can fit that mold and fill that role. I do think we're going to get past this, but I don't say that in an optimistic way. I don't say it's like, oh, this is all going to pass. We're all going to be fine. No, that is not what I mean by this. The Trump era will be a moment. It's what comes after that I'm worried about. But there will be an after. So that's my only tinted optimism that I've got right now.
That's pretty good, because usually you're the downer. That's actually, you've given us a hope that we might actually survive.
I'm not saying it's going to be a good after. I'm just saying there's going to be an after.
That's good. I mean, it beats the apocalypse, Susan. Usually it's like, you know.
I didn't define what the after is. It could be that.
Ah, Susan, you are a ray of light.
But I will say, the Trump era will come to a close. That I feel confident about.
And he is declining mentally and physically. It's happening before our very eyes.
Biology is on our side, folks.
Yeah, no, seriously, he's declining. I mean, I'm not one to make any, you know, I'm not a doctor, but like, just look at his speeches. Like, that's not normal. You could tell that something's off there.
Modern science is going to be so much. He is an old guy. Like, everything else aside, we got that on our favor. So whatever.
And he doesn't really eat that healthy.
And he definitely doesn't eat that healthy. Neither do I, so I can't judge him, but hey. Anyway, next week we have a lot to talk about what else is going on in Trump's retribution tour with Vindman and the whole snafu with Jesse Liu, who just got her nomination withdrawn from Treasury, as well as several other retaliatory moves Trump has made. But I think that's enough pessimism for this week. So thank you, Waj, for joining us.
Thank you, as always. I feel like an adult speaking from my home and not my minivan. This was an encouraging moment for me. A plus one moment for me.
I got to ask, how's it been since you had that appearance, which I still have not watched, by the way, but I've seen from Twitter that there was a thing with you and Rick Wilson.
So two weeks ago, I was on Don Lemon's show with me and Rick Wilson, and we were talking about, and everyone's forgotten, Mike Pompeo humiliating and berating veteran NPR journalist Mary Louise Kelly, and then he threw F-bombs and he brought out a map and said, point out Ukraine. And she did. And then the next day he lied and said that she pointed out to Bangladesh.
Ukraine's not Bangladesh.
Yeah. But I mean, and then so we were mocking his cruelty and we were mocking Trump's ignorance, because Trump is the man who, by the way, doesn't know that India borders China and Belgium is a country and on and on and on. And so we just had some fun and Don Lemon just died laughing for about a minute. And because Rick said, if you put a U and a picture of a crane on a map, that's the only way Trump will know that there's Ukraine. 2 days passed. Everyone laughed. No one cared. And there was manufactured outrage by the right-wing ecosystem, always crying victimhood. And they made an ad about it. And for like the last 2 weeks, I've just been the target of this incestuous group. And they work in coordination. Like, I'm convinced they're all in the same WhatsApp, because it was like Daily Caller, 20 minutes later, Town Hall, 20 minutes later, Fox News, 10 minutes later, Breitbart, next day, ad. Like, it just magically happened. You know what I'm saying? And so they were like being butthurt and crying and saying, oh, look at CNN and the liberals and the elites. They're mocking you, real America. They're mocking half of America. And because God is good, within the week, before the week was over, Kansas City Chiefs won the Super Bowl. And Donald Trump, the president of the United States, tweets out that Kansas City Chiefs are from Kansas. But they're not. They're from Missouri. And of course, as we said, he mocks the accent of Chuck Grassley. And we have video clips of him mocking the accent of Jeff Sessions. But when the chosen one does it, it's okay. So I've been trolled for 2 weeks. But the trick is, if you've been trolled by Trump or his MAGA people, never give in, never show weakness, never get flustered. They hate it when you fight back. It kills them. They're like fifth grade insecure bullies. Remember them, Susan? They want you just to take the L. That's what they want you. Why don't you just shut up and take the L? And I try to play like Bugs Bunny and have fun with them. And they're promoting the clip more and more, and I just promote it for them ever since Trump tweeted out the Kansas City gaffe, which proves our point, and it's kind of killing them. So that's how it's been. But it's been fun. I've got a lot of hate mail. I'll share it next time. If you invite me next time, I'll
read
some of
them. I want your best hate mail next time you're on. Like, get the best of it, the select hate mail. The finest choices of hate mail that you've received.
I will choose the creme de la creme, and the audience will thoroughly enjoy it.
Cannot wait. Until then, Waj, thanks for coming on.
Take care.
Bye.
A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. And you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.